Okay, so welcome to anybody who's coming along. We'll have to see who joined us. This is the first time I'm trying to stream it live on Facebook and YouTube at the same time. And I think we have a few people watching, so we'll have to keep an eye on that. We're back to the first time this year. Actually, we've got a group of brewers back for a kind of a round table chat. So we have an interesting mix, I think. Starting above me, as I'm looking at it here, we have Gediminas from Kuru Aparaturu, or Aparatura in Vilnius in Lithuania. Then we have Andre from Brekariat in Sweden. And we have Daniel from Ofiusa in Portugal. And I know I spelt it wrong. So I have my apologies for that. But this is an interesting mix because I think you've got quite a range of beer styles, really. I think it's fair to say. It's hard to kind of, but there is no one beer style that you all specialize in, let's put it that way. So maybe what we can do is we can start maybe with you, Gediminas, since I introduced you first. Maybe we could just quickly go around, kind of just say who you are and where the brewery came from and, you know, where it's at now, and then we can get into a chat about the beers and about the beer scenes and things of that. So do you want to, Gediminas, do you want to just give us a little background?
Sure. So Kuru Aparatura is about five and a little bit years old. We started with a couple of friends, and I was home brewing before. So it was kind of a natural extension. You know, I think it's quite usual in the craft brewing world. And we've been brewing for 5 years in the center of Vilnius in a really nice multicultural building, which used to be a railway employees cultural palace or something like that. I don't know how to translate it. So it's a really small brewery, like a really micro brewery. So we are not brewing that much, but we've developed quite a few recipes over the years, and well, intend to keep creating new recipes in the future.
Right. Am I right that you took the name from the building?
It's not the same building. We often get that question. The name is of an old factory in Vilnius, which is in another part of town. It used to make fuel engine parts, basically, various fuel injection parts and so on. And it was one of the biggest factories in Lithuania, so everybody in Vilnius knows it, and but most people in Lithuania know it. So it's kind of like an industrial name, which is also pointing to Vilnius, like location right. Reference, basically.
But no one gets confused and tries to order an engine off you or anything like that.
Actually, we had one guy inquiring some long time ago, but it was just one case.
Okay. Well, once it doesn't happen too often. How about you, Andre? You've been around a bit longer, have you?
We started a bearing import company in 2010. And then the brewery 2012. So last year it was 10 years.
Okay.
We're three brothers running it, and we mainly focus on wild yeast fermentation and sour beers.
Right. Yeah, we can get into that because I think a bit later maybe we can get into that because I believe we kind of fell into that by accident. But we'll come back to that bit. And you've been trying to get out of it ever since, if I read your website. So we'll see about that. Daniel, how about you down there? How long are you in business?
Well, I think we are the youngest ones. We launched our brewery like 2 years ago. 1 week from now, we are turning 2 years. We launched with three partners, but I was alone brewing and doing everything for almost a year. And now I then put an internee, and 3 months ago I employed that guy. So now we are just two guys brewing. We have a 6 hectoliter system and some fermenters of 6 and 12 hectoliters.
Right.
And we are specializing, or at least trying to in New England IPAs, West Coast IPAs, smoothie sours. For that time being, at least we are opening doors each year. I want to open one particular door in terms of a style. This year, I would love to do some like sour IPAs and specialize a little bit in barrel-aged imperial stouts and something like that. We then have a core range. I think the beers I sent to you guys was a part of our core range. There are five beers in our core range. It's a saison, like an hoppy saison with New Zealand hops, Mutwek and Ossensova. And then we have a milk stout. We have a West Coast IPA, a New England pale ale, and a smoothie sour, a strawberry smoothie sour. That's the five beer core range we brew. And then every month we release like one or two specialty beers, one-offs. We do like 1,000 liters and move on.
Okay. So yeah.
That's it.
Okay, so you started basically just a week or two before everyone closed down. No.
Yep.
In the middle.
In the middle. But when I leave my old job, like 2 weeks after I leave my old job, me and one of the other partners, we are three founders, but two of us start the brewing, like installing the brewery and so on for at least 1 year. And when we leave our jobs to start the process, like 2 years after, COVID came but it was too late to not move on. So right. We just move on. Went smoothly, thanks to God.
I suppose everybody has stories about how the COVID thing basically hit. Does that hit either of yourself, Andre, or Ketamine? It's like, were you selling mainly to bars or were you selling to retail? Like, because that obviously would have had a big impact on your sales.
Most definitely. I don't know, Andre, what about you? I'll let you go first.
Me? Go, Andre.
Yeah, we had quite a lot of beer on export, but that, of course, all overnight, it just went down to zero. So we had to focus more on the local market, on the Swedish, both retail, but also the alcohol and monopoly retail stores we have in Sweden.
Okay.
And also focus on the session beers. And we started to ferment the vegetables, kimchi and other things to be able to sell for people to get access to easier.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I think someone has a little bit of feedback there somewhere. I'm not sure who.
I'm wearing headphones, so it's,
yes. I don't know. Maybe Gediminas, could you try and just mute yourself there for a second? We'll just see if we can fix this and figure out where it's coming from. Okay, is that better? Nope. How about you, Daniel? Could you mute yourself and we'll see if we can just narrow down where? I think that's it. Yeah, I think that's the thing. So if you don't mind, if you can kind of mute and unmute, it might help. So So you were the same. Were you selling mainly to bars or?
Yeah. When the COVID hit, we were still really young. So our probably 95% of sales went to bars and restaurants. So it hit us really hard. But of course, we did everything we could to find alternative sales channels. So we opened our e-shop, we started doing like online tastings, which became quite popular, like even as corporate Christmas party events or something, you know. And of course we started selling to shops, so we got by somehow, but yeah, it was tough.
Right. And what's the, maybe we can just get into the beers at the moment, because you did also announce some beers, and I know I seem to be the only person who received everything, but so I'm the lucky one. I've been kind of slowly sipping them over the last week. And there's quite a mix of there, I think. I think, Daniel, you're probably, because you sent your core range, you come across maybe is more of the mainstream, whereas like Andre would be more niche in the sours and all of that. And is that something that you need to have in Portugal, that you need to have kind of what is the beer scene? What is everybody looking for there? Because, how does that work out?
Yeah, in Portugal, most of the market is pretty small, to be honest. Like there are three or four big breweries in Portugal, but the biggest breweries like Dois Corvos, it's a pretty small brewery, not like Braqueriet or something like that. So, and every brewery has their own core range. We had that decision in the beginning to have or not to have a core range. And we understood that it's pretty important to have a core range to get a good representation in terms of styles and to have a little bit lower priced beers, because the other beers we do, because the scale is so small and we are in the extreme east of Europe, so every raw material is pretty expensive to get here, and to export is also pretty expensive to export. So it's a little bit expensive to make beer in our country, and it's a poor country. Really, the normal income in Portugal is very low. So we understood that it's really important to have a good core range with a lower price point. And then every month we turn some one-off beers to get to do what we really want to do. So I think it's important to have a core range.
Right. So
in Portugal alone, but yeah.
So it's that balance between kind of what the market wants and what you would like to brew.
Yeah, but I really love to experiment in other styles. We are just too new to develop. We don't have the right equipment to do certain styles like centrifuges with time we will get there with some time.
And how about you, Andre? Let's get into this thing. You if I understand from correctly, you started off trying to brew kind of, let's say, mainstream beers. You made a mess and got stuck in sour wild beers, and you've been trying to get back ever since.
Yeah, not exactly. When we started to import beers in 2010, we mainly focused on beers that weren't already present in Sweden, such as saisons and also a spontaneous fermented cider from France and such things. And during those 2 years, we realized that we wanted to focus on that when we eventually started to brew ourselves. So right from the beginning, we had wild yeast fermentation in all of our beers. But then in 2013, we started to mess around with also barrel fermentation and sour lactic acid bacteria cultures and such. And such, because we were that small, we couldn't separate things, and we didn't have enough money or equipment to keep everything separated. And eventually, even the Brett beers got sour and moved to a larger facility in 2015. We managed to get back to this only Brett beers, non-sour beers. But then at that point, we break.
We lost you. I think we lost them.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, well, let's move on. So,
not necessarily sour.
Okay, so sorry, we lost there for a second. So, yeah, so how are you doing the sour beers? I mean, you're known for it now. That's what like people think of you in Sweden. They think of sour beers, and you're doing sour beers? Is it? It's not spontaneous fermentation. It's
and not we have two separate two separate fermentation areas. One where we have the stainless steel, we ferment only with Brett, and the other one is all fermented in barrel aged barrels in different sizes. Okay. And those beers are spontaneously fermented.
All right. Okay. So you have cool ships.
So
and all
the
that.
The two ones in the big bottles, they're spontaneously fermented. The ones in cans are only Brett.
Okay.
And in most cases, kettle sours with no live bacteria cultures, but kettle sours.
Okay. Yeah, because I tried.
And you have two brands, right? For those different beers, two different brands, Wild Brews and.
Yeah, so the Wild Brews is non-sour beers at the moment, and the Breakery it is sour beers in different styles, both kettle sours and spontaneously fermented.
And is there a big market for sours in Sweden?
Not really, but and that's also why we've had a lot of export during the years, because we haven't been able to just focus on the market in Sweden. We have to already from the beginning, we needed to try to get our beers abroad just to be able to sell and grow.
Right. Yeah, I suppose what I'm getting at is, like, do you think it's been an advantage to be known for a particular style, or is it a disadvantage? Like, just comparing to what Daniel's doing there, like with his core range that is spreading a wide gamut of stuff.
I think definitely more of an advantage than disadvantage. But as I said earlier, I don't know if you heard me or if I the connection was bad, but when we in 2016 tried to do non-sours because we had the possibility, nobody wanted to drink non-sour beers from Breakery because we were known as a sour beer brewery. And that's why we created the Wild Brews brand.
Right, that's this one.
So the bitter is, it's a classic bitter, but it's with wild yeast. Fermented with wild yeast.
Okay, and sorry, I'll just stick with you. Sorry, but the that wild yeast, is it something that you harvested somewhere and you're now having as a house culture, or where did you get the?
It's a Brett B from the beginning, but we have had the same cultures for many years. So it's we just keep it alive in a tank, in a fermentation tank.
Okay, so you
and then we.
Is it constantly evolving?
Yeah. It is.
Okay.
And we have also. We have stored culture in the freezer if something goes bad with the current bacteria current culture.
Okay, and do you just replace that or add to that storage then once in a while, I suppose, with the latest variety?
Yeah, if we notice something is going either direction, just as it doesn't differ too much.
Okay.
But it's very stable as it is.
Okay. No, but I drank some the other night. There was some very nice, was it Beta? That one was very nice. I don't know if any of
you. Yeah, and that one is barrel aged and dry hop.
Yeah, I thought it was very, I don't know. I thought it was quite delicate, and I gave it to my wife, and she just kind of nearly spat it up. She thought it was way too sour. Awesome. But but I suppose I must have adapted my palate because I thought it was very delicate. I don't know if that's what the intention was, or if we're going off the wrong way, but
it also is, of course, it depends on what you maybe expect. Yeah. If you only know it's a beer, you expect it not to be sour, but
yeah, well, she doesn't really
if you buy it and you know it's from Breakery, you should you you most likely know it is a sour.
Right. And how would you get, I mean, so do you have a core range? Because you've sent a quite a wide variety of, I don't know how to classify them, to be honest with you.
All right. So we do have a core range, but it's actually about 6-7 beers that we make regularly. When we started out, we didn't really have any particular niche we wanted to work on. We were quite late to the market, but still, you know, the craft beer market was quite small in Lithuania, so there were lots of options for us to explore. So we basically just made whatever we wanted to make or drink, you know. So we actually started out with a Belgian double. We started out gypsying actually at first, so without any money, without nothing, just you know, this kind of tongue-in-cheek attitude to just give it a shot. And then we developed all the recipes along the way. And the interesting tangent here is sour beers, because we have probably half of our range now is sour beers, actually. I think I've sent some of them to you. They are all kettle sours, because we have a very small brewery in all separate areas, and we don't want to risk experimenting with anything more than kettle sours at the moment. But everyone in our brewery really loves sours, and it's been quite a journey since the first sour that we brewed. It was a classic Gose, a German Gose, without any, you know, fruits, just coriander and salt. We did a classic version just because there was no classic version in Lithuania, and it's probably, to me, it's just a most it's my favorite version of Gose, you know. It has the complexity that kind of is lost when you add fruit, if you know what I mean. So at first it was really hard to sell it, even though it was light and not too sour, and you know, it was basically a summer beer that and then the sales died during the winter, really. But over the years, as we made more sour recipes, the market has caught up, basically. And yeah, now half of the beer we sell is sour beers. So we even have a sour non-alcoholic beer. I don't know if I've included it. Basically a sour IPA, which is 0.5 ABV, which is considered non-alcoholic in Lithuania. So yeah, we have a mixture of various beers. We still don't have a specific niche we want to go to. With the way we define our brewing is basically we are looking for drinkability and subtle complexity. That's about as tight as we can define it, you know.
Because the Lithuanian market, I don't know if the other two have any knowledge. I mean, I've a little bit of knowledge just from talking to people and that, but it seems to me like a unique market, because you've still got all the traditional farmhouse brewers are kind of in existence, and they're quite widely available, and there's yes, a lot of influence from that. But then you've got really kind of quite nearly avant-garde brewers, like a bit like what you're doing, and Sakishkis are, I would classify as some of the, you know, some kind of slightly off the wall beers as well. So do you think that's like, is that the same market? Is it two different groups of people? How do you, what do you think the beer market is in Lithuania?
Oh, it is, as you say, it's very diverse, and there's definitely, I think, different groups of beer lovers that like those different beers. And as you say, the traditional or countryside beer, as it is called here, was quite strong in Lithuania already. I think it was actually the start of beer revolution, let's say, whatever, if we can call it so, in Lithuania. So before craft beer, there was a revival of all the traditional beers, basically. And then later came craft beer with Dundulis and then Sakishkis. And I think just like Sakishkis, we went into the other way from the traditional brewing, just because we had lots of it already, you know, and we were really interested in in just creating new recipes and experimenting with you know, classic style interpretations and things like that, which was not really a thing in Lithuania. I mean, it was lacking in our opinion. So yeah, now we have this kind of modern avant-garde brewing, as you say. We have the traditional farmhouse or countryside beers, and we have the big industrial brewers, and also the small industrial brewers who are a bit of everything. You know, they are trying to do a little bit of maybe traditional flavored beers and a bit of industrial. So yeah, it's a mixture, which is good. I mean, that was the main reason we started brewing, to have higher diversity.
I take it you still have the same thing that probably everyone has in Sweden and in Portugal as well. You have the large brewers then setting up their little craft brands that they're still brewing at scale and that.
Yes.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. I guess you have the same thing. Do you see that as a problem, or do you see that, like all three of you, do you see that as, because they come in, they brew beer as a cheaper thing, and they use the kind of the whole craft image, but does it, like, is it a problem, or does it kind of expand the market?
It's a very good question. Yes and no. I used to see it as a problem, like just as a problem, and that's it. Because, you know, they are kind of stealing the market from the craft brewers who are true craft brewers. I mean, like they are, you know, home brewers turned craft brewers and are doing all on their, like, I don't know, family money or something. But after a few years, I started thinking differently. Just I see them just as part of the beer movement, because one, they are still contributing to diversity. I mean, their beers are improving, in my opinion. Like, I prefer those, you know, crafty beers than the industrial beers, so to say. And on the other hand, they are also investing a lot of money in this market. So they are actually educating the consumer, the task that we are also set out to do, you know, just because that's the only way to expand the creative beer market, basically. So I see them now as just any other, so to say, competitor and friend. Like, I consider all brewers basically kind of friends in the same boat, and not as competitors in the way that, you know, we are at each other's neck, but more as probably friends participating in the same competition, let's say.
Right.
So Robert,
I see Daniel, you're nodding along there. I think that seems to be something you agree with.
Yeah, to be honest, I totally agree with Gediminas. In Portugal, we have two big brands of industrial beer, Superbock and Sagres. And like 5 or 6 years ago, they started to launch some small brands inside the big brands doing other styles than Pilsner. And to be honest, nowadays, I totally agree with Gediminas, because they have the money and they have the power to educate all the consumer around other styles. So nowadays, they truly have a role in the market, because they educate people, they advocate people into new styles, and they bring people to our niche. So it's truly important to have them in our side. And they, here in Portugal at least, they have an important role. They organize some festivals, but most of all, that's the thing. That's the big thing. They educate people around other styles. They make people understand there is something other than pilsners and industrial lagers.
Right.
Yeah, so it's very important.
Andre, you're agreeing with that, yeah?
I agree with the educating part, and but I think, because it's a cheaper product, I guess it's hard, or people are maybe not willing, even though they realize that they enjoy a style, that the price differs so much that maybe they're not willing to spend those extra money, even though it's a craft beer instead of the Carlsberg sub-brand. So I agree and I disagree. I I like it, and I don't like it, as you two said as well.
Yeah. No, I guess it is a hard one. Like, I mean, yeah, there's people coming in and taking what is still a small market, really, in craft beer. I mean, you know, in Europe, it's
yeah,
still.
Because they're able to produce the same beer much cheaper, of course, and sell it cheaper to the customer.
Yeah, I guess if there was a bit more kind of honesty, but they set up a brand that is almost. They kind of disown the brand. They just set the a lot of them set up the brand, and they don't have highlight any link back to themselves. Whereas at least if they did that, you'd have something that people would know that, look, this is not a completely craft beer, but
yeah, they produce it with the label design and other things for people to think it's maybe a craft beer. Just to gain market shares, I think, but and that's somehow not totally okay in my book, but it doesn't say specifically which big beer brand it is on the label.
Yeah, whereas if it was like a Carlsberg sour beer or something, then it would be different because they'd be introducing the sour, but.
Exactly.
Then, yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk. That there were some of the beers. Maybe just mention. I wanted to ask about one that you sent. Get me is this one because I couldn't figure out what was in it. But I nearly drank it on goal during the week.
So this is the beer I've mentioned before. This was our very first beer. We call it Caribbean Double. It's basically a Belgian double base, but instead of candy syrup or candy sugar, we use Muscovado sugar and date syrup. So it's quite strong, 7.1 ABV, and we now only brew it in the autumn for the winter season. It's our strongest beer and seasonal at the moment.
Okay.
We also have it on tap, which I prefer, the tap version. So if you ever get a chance, give it a shot.
Okay.
And otherwise, how did you like it?
I don't know whether I was just thirsty that day, but I drank about half of it in one go. it didn't feel like 7%. I didn't check.
Okay.
You mentioned that, yeah, it does say that. I didn't realize when I was drinking it. So whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know.
I think it's good.
It felt very light. It felt much lighter than 7%, which is, which, like I said, good or bad, I don't know, because maybe you should know when there's that much alcohol. But but it was very drinkable, very, very drinkable, I thought.
Great. That's our goal.
And it brings up the thing.
I haven't tried it, but I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, no, it was nice. Brings up something you mentioned there on tap. So do you all have tap rooms? Do you or no tap rooms, or what's your situation?
Operatura has no tap rooms. That's quite an issue, because pretty much all other brewers, craft brewers, they have the either tap rooms or something along those lines. We have this in the future plans, but it's more like a long-term plan. We tried to open a shop, a bar shop in a kind of food hall on the. It's not really the suburbs, but it's not in the center of the city. But it didn't really work out, so we closed it after about a year. And right now we're still just, you know, we still have it in the plans, so to say.
And how about you, Andre? Do you have one?
No, not at the moment, but we're looking at new facilities where we will be able to also open a tap room. So hopefully this summer we will have the grand premiere.
Okay.
And we've always also... At the moment, we just received a couple of new fermenters where we will be able to produce clean beers, which is very exciting, but also very terrifying. So hopefully we will be able to sell also pilsners and IPAs at the taproom.
Okay, and that'll be ones you're planning to brew yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not...
So hopefully everything goes as planned.
And Daniel, I guess if you're that new, you don't have a taproom either.
We had a taproom in the early beginning. As soon as COVID went out, we opened a taproom here in the factory. But the factory is not in the center. We are near Lisbon, like 50 kilometers away. But we are from a city called Setúbal. It's like a small city. And we opened a taproom in the factory. We just opened like Fridays and Saturdays. Okay. But because I was all alone, I spent all my life in here, and to spend also the weekend and not being with my wife and my daughters, it was fucking too much. So I kept it open for almost 1 year, and is running. It was running decently good, but to be honest, at that time and still until that until today, we are solding out all our batches, all our products pretty fast. So because the production is pretty small and there is some quite people looking for our product. So it didn't make any sense to sold out the product and to get that effort to be here at the weekend. We definitely lose that personal contact with the clients, but I think it was the best decision to my personal life, to be honest. So nowadays I close the tap room like in last August. We do have our beers on tap in many bars in Lisbon and Porto, but because we sell them kegs to the resellers, like beer pubs and beer halls and stuff like that, but we don't have a tap room. I am planning to have a tap room in the near future, like 1 or 2 years from now, probably in Lisbon, but it's just a dream. There is not even a plan right now.
So it sounds like
I think we need to increase a little bit our production to get to a taproom make sense to us. Because nowadays, as I said before, we are solding out our product so fast, it doesn't make any sense to make it to have a taproom.
Do you think that that's you need to be a certain size? Or because I've talked to some other people and they felt, like you said, that contact makes a huge difference in building up your brand.
Yeah.
But do you need you feel you need to be a certain size that before a tap room makes sense?
I think so. We now we produce like 35 hectoliters per month, so it's a very small brewery, and yeah, the tap room makes all the sense to me to have the contact with the client for sure, but also to not to get rid of the product, but I don't see any sense to have a taproom that serves like 50% of my products and not having product to sell to my resellers or for export. Or I think that at least that is my priority.
Yeah. So what about the two? So like you didn't start off with a taproom. You're now trying to build it. Do you think? I guess where does the taproom fit into this in terms of, you know, you get a higher margin, but well, yeah, but if you can sell it outside at a lower margin, are you better off? Where's the? I guess I'm trying to figure out my question here. if you can sell, and you have your distribution, then you want to be a brewer. You don't want to be a barman. But if you're having trouble selling, then the tap room does give you that benefit that you can, but you probably need to hire a staff. You need to have a staff for it. You can't do it yourself.
Yeah. I think so. And a tap room must be very functional to things make sense. You have to, you must have a tap room that really sells and have some food to eat. So the margins are a little big. A little bit higher to everything makes sense. I would love to have a taproom. To be honest, is the part of this business is the part that I do not love, to be honest. The taproom part. I love managing, I love the sales part, I love the brewing part, I love everything in this business. But the taproom part, I don't really love it. So it makes sense to me to have someone by my side to get that part done.
Okay.
Maybe in the near future with a little bit more, a bigger scale. Yeah. And it's very important to me to that the product reach the client faster as possible in terms of smoothie sours and New England IPAs. This is not beer that you have like sour beers or imperial stouts that there is no problem to aging them a little bit. But with our kind of beer, it's really important to get things done fast. And nowadays, in a small tap room like we had before, like a keg of 20 or 30 liters, it spent like 2 or 3 or 4 weeks to get it sold out.
Okay.
And it's too much time for me. Yeah.
Okay.
The so last glasses you serve, they are not fresh enough.
Okay, that's surprising. I hadn't thought about it in terms of, yeah, you have to guarantee you have a big enough tap room to get that sold.
That's fast, yeah, and fresh.
And do you, Gediminas, do you think that's something you're going to face? Well, you're doing a lot of sours, but is your tap room that you're planning, it'll be in the center of the list? But like, you think it'll get that footfall through that it's needed, or... You're mute. No, I think it's muted yourself, have you?
Yeah, I have muted it. I forgot about it. So yeah, I think we would definitely have all our beers on tap at our tap room. But I really agree with Daniel here that, I mean, if you are selling all your beers already to other bars, then it's kind of, it doesn't make sense to open a tap room. It's more like a step-by-step thing, you know, you grow capacity, then you open a tap room, it grows the capacity more, then you can add more capacity to grow. So it's a tool we would definitely want to have, especially as you said, you know, contact with your customers, but also as a place, you know, to do, let's say, your presentations, like new beer release events and things like that, and maybe even, you know, have a kind of fan-based beer for like every couple of months or something like that. So there are many interactions that we are interested in having with the customer directly that we don't have right now. So our only contact point is basically festivals, and that's about it. And maybe some of our events that we do. We just had an event like on Wednesday, but we just did a tap takeover at a bar, which is kind of our friend's bar. And we did some food along the beach, and it's a great way of spending time with your customers, you know, having some nice food and nice beers there, and maybe a chat here and there. So yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to that. But if you intend to open a tap room, then you need to have a business plan for it, and you know, you will not really get a higher margin there, because you have to sustain the taproom itself, you know, so the location, the premises, the staff, and everything. So I see it more as just an additional channel where you can actually communicate with your customer directly, and which, well, adds to your sales, but not in the way that adds to your margins.
Right. Yeah, because I'm sorry to harp on about this, because it surprised me a little bit, because I keep, like in Ireland, brewers have a hugely hard time to get a tap room, that you just cannot get a license. And I just keep hearing people complain, you know, that we need to be able to get a license for a tap room. It's kind of the make or break point of the brewery. So I think this is the first time I've heard people kind of highlight the negatives of a tap room. So it surprised me. But when you think about it, I mean, yeah, I mean, it is a cap. Well, I suppose it depends on the size of your brewery. Again, we're back to that. Like, it's capital intensive in terms of if you have a small brewery, but if you have a reasonable sized brewery, the extra capital is probably not that high, and you have that way of getting some margin. Would that be kind of summing it up?
I think so. It really depends on the size. So there could be different business cases for that. You know, maybe you just open a brew pub and you don't sell outside, but only sell your beer in your brew pub, and that also works. But if you sell outside, then you have to produce enough beer to both satisfy your outside customers and to satisfy your taproom needs. So yeah, it goes hand in hand with growing your brewery. You have to find a good place, point in time to open it.
And that's the situation for us. The new facilities we're looking at is actually to move the brewery itself. So the tap room will actually be a brew pub inside the brewery facilities to have tastings and tours, and also combine it with the restaurant next door to be able to have like a package of first dinner and then a tour and the tasting. But of course, we want to keep the margin, but we also we need to produce more beer, of course, to be able to both keep our customers, but also keep people coming to the brew pub, I hope they're thirsty. we need to have a lot of beer to the brew pub itself, of course.
Yeah. I guess then you do need, because like I said, if you were just doing sours, you're only going to get a small number of people. That's where you need to have your wider range of beers.
Exactly. We need to have from Pilsner to stout to barrel-aged sours to be able to attract everyone.
Because you
wouldn't. It wouldn't make sense only to only pour sours at the brew pub. Of course, a lot of people would have come, but maybe not everyone.
Yeah, and even the people who were big fans of yours, then they couldn't bring their friends because their friends may not be. So you have to have a good core. So that makes sense. That makes sense. So I mean, the scenes in each country, I think it's reasonably similar. So the beer scenes seem to be very vibrant in each of the countries there. They're relatively new. Well, maybe more established in Sweden than in Portugal or Lithuania, but still vibrant.
To be honest, in Portugal, we are a wine country. We are not a beer country at all, and we import the culture mainly from the United States, from the craft beer revolution in the United States, and some Belgium stuff and culture. But yeah, most of all, we are a wine country, and we have plenty of clients to advocate and to educate. Because we consume and we love wine, not beer.
Yeah, I've heard that's kind of a good thing, because if you get, you don't have to convert into new styles of beer all the time. Just once you convert someone from wine, or at least to try it, I mean, not, you don't have to replace wine, but once you get them to try it, at least they're willing to open up. Like, you just have that one thing to change. I think...
I don't understand the question.
I don't know. I was just kind of commenting there that, like, in some cases, converting people from, say, to like converting people from, say, a lager, a macro lager, to try different types of beers can actually be harder than getting them to change from trying wine to at least trying a beer one time, you know. That people who have been drinking Budweiser all their life really are kind of pretty set in their ways and won't try anything.
I think you need to try people to realize that craft beer can, in most cases, be as good as wine to, let's say, a good meal or just in good company.
Yeah.
And, yeah, of course, the craft beer industry isn't that... We're still young in every country, so I think it's a goal, but it takes a lot of time.
Yeah,
indeed.
It's actually something about that just occurred to me there. The food, I mean, wine, you associate, you know, you go into a restaurant, you have a huge wine list, you have, and they'll advise you on what wine to go with, what food. Has any of that kind of, in any of the three countries, is that kind of established as with beer, or is it still just you go in and they have maybe two or three macro beers on tap and that's it? You just take what you're given.
Here in Portugal, we have some, in Porto and Lisbon, most of all, we have some spots that really do that kind of job. They have some very nice foods, and they have specialized staff to pairing the food with beer. But we are talking about two or three spots in the whole country. So I think the answer is no, there isn't. It's a long shot. It's a mission, it's a goal, but every small town have a specialty house for that kind of business with wine, but not with beer.
Okay. Yeah, that's probably the same in Sweden and Lithuania as well, I guess.
Well, in Lithuania, it's slowly getting there, as there are some restaurants that are offering beer pairings, including among our customers. So I was really happy, this last autumn, we did a tasting, basically food tasting, which was paired with our beers. So we prepared beforehand, you know, with all the chefs, we discussed what we would like to make and how to pair it with our beers. And then we went there as well, all with brewery guys, and we were delivering the beers ourselves and commenting, you know, on the pairings and on the beers. And so it was kind of also an educational tasting event, which I really enjoyed the format. And this restaurant is actually in Birštonas, which is a fairly small town, a resort town. But of course, we have more fine dining restaurants that are also doing some beer and food pairings, but yeah, it's not a regular, it's definitely not regular, it's more like a niche thing so far, and probably 99% of all the fine dining events or places, they do just pairings with the wine, but they may have some craft beers on tap, you know, but usually all the pairings are just done with wine.
Actually, that's another thing, just on the packaging. So, I mean, beers on tap coming from your, if you are looking in the, you know, pair with your food. And I wonder about cans. I always find drinking out of cans nice, but it always seems to be like bottles in, you know, if I go to a restaurant and they gave me a can of beer, I think I'd still be a little bit there. You know, I'd be a little bit, it's not quite up to high standards. I mean, do you think everyone knows that the cans are just as good? They're, you know, that they're easier to transport, they're more recyclable, blah, blah, blah. But I noticed, take Bricariate, you have your cans, but you also have the really fancy ones in bottles. Where do you think that lays down, where it's off of use, where all cans, you know, do you think there is still that kind of scene of bottles are better, or they're preserved for higher quality beers? Let's just say quality in inverted commas.
I definitely realized that a fancy restaurant would want to maybe pour the beers from a bottle or present it in the fridge in bottle instead of can. But it also it goes together with the young craft beer market. It's still and cans in that for that matter is also very young phenomenon, which will probably only be more usual for every brewery to use. But we don't want to put the barrel aged beers in cans because we think it's beers made for bottles. They've been sitting in barrels for at least 12 months, and we need a separate canning line, and we want the package itself to tell the customer that this is a more exclusive product than the kettle sours we can. Which also makes it easier for the customers to realize why they have to pay X amount of the euros more for the bottle than for the can because of the production time. And
to be honest, I really think go Andre. Sorry.
I'm done.
We made that decision to go all cans. We are not doing all cans now. In the last 1.5 months, we release our first beers on bottle, barrel-aged imperial stouts. Just like Andre said, I think some beers like true sour beers or barrel-aged imperial stouts, I really think they deserve a bottle. And I really think they deserve that kind of packaging and they gain to be in the bottle. But other stuff like our core range, it makes all the sense to be in a can because of the export and the costs and the recycling and the transport costs. And to be honest, I really think like one of our focus is West Coast IPAs and New England IPAs, and that kind of beer really appreciates to be in a can because of the oxidation and because of the sunlight and everything else. It's just a more stable product after 6 or 7 months, or like after 3 or 4 months, they are almost the same as we taste in the fermenter. So it's really important for us. Our beers, thanks to God, they are drink like in 2 or 3 months, every end customer gets our beer into a glass. They are not waiting like 1 year to be drinked. Nowadays, we put like 6 months best before in our can West Coast and New England IPAs. And it's the kind of beer that really appreciates a can in many. And it was a big point in our decision to go cans. It's the canvas for the illustration, for the communication, for the branding of the company. It's a much bigger way to communicate the brand and to have some good illustrations in it. So that was our decision to go all cans.
Yeah, because I mean, cans obviously have taken over, but it's interesting to hear that you both feel still that kind of bottles have this aesthetic value that's a little bit above cans.
They really have.
Because even when, like, again, coming back to Ireland, I was amazed kind of 2 years ago, you started seeing people and, you know, breweries would start putting their beers in cans, and then you'd see people posting on, you know, or talking around and saying it's finally in a can, and the customers were delighted. And I don't know, maybe I can see it, but yeah, the bottle has that aesthetic. And it's just interesting to hear that you both feel it. Gediminas, yours, just since we're talking about bottling, I mean, yours are like, I held that one up a while ago. You've got stubby bottles.
Yes.
Was that availability or was it choice?
It was choice, yeah. We just wanted a cool looking bottle. So we liked this one and we started out with it. And yeah, it's the cans thing, it's a problem for us because we started pouring some of our beers into cans, like the very, very core range, the four core beers. We also had the same idea that, you know, well, hoppy beers are much better than cans for sure. And we wanted to do like the core range available for shops, like supermarkets, you know, in cans. But the thing is, nobody wants to take them. So, yeah, on one hand, there is this education thing. So we are, of course, explaining every time we can that can is a better packaging for beer. On the other hand, yeah, we see the same that, you know, many of our customers are, let's say, fine dining restaurants, for example, who don't even want to talk about cans. But then there are also just regular consumers who just prefer bottles, you know, and they like the aesthetic probably. And as you say, maybe they prefer seeing a bottle next to their, you know, dinner at home instead of a can. So it is a mixed bag. We are still not sure if we want to continue with the cans. Like last week we had a meeting talking about this, and it seems that, yeah, either we have to go like to switch totally to cans so that, you know, we don't give another option to the customers, or we will try to have both maybe, but then we'll probably have to make cans significantly cheaper and yeah, find ways to sell them basically.
So Lithuania is still
very much definitely open. Yeah, the cans in Lithuania is still a very kind of, I don't want to say frowned upon, but pretty much 90% of people still think that bottle is a better packaging for beer, even though it's vice versa.
Yeah, I can see that's wrong. But like I said, that was the case I would have said in Ireland 2-3 years ago. And then it suddenly switched on what appeared to me like overnight. And suddenly everybody can. So maybe it'll have there. The only other country I can think of where, you know, where bottles are still the main thing is like where I am, it's Belgium, that they refuse to handle cans at all.
Here in Portugal until like 2 years ago, bottle, it was just like Edminas was saying, bottles was the main, even the bigger brands like Dois Corvos and Musa and Letra, they were all doing bottles. No one want to switch to cans. We were the first ones to do cans since day one. And after us, like 6 months later, Dois Corvos, that is the bigger brand of craft brewery here in Portugal, they started doing cans. And that changed, like you said, from day to night, it changed the market completely. People are buying cans for like 5, 6, 7, 8 years here in Portugal from the United States, from the rest of the Europe. And the beer geeks, at least, they already know that cans is the shit. Cans is the way to do the good packaging for certain kinds of beer. But in Portugal, the majority of the client doesn't have that perception until like 2 years ago. Nowadays, I think because of us and because of the Corvus and Letra nowadays is doing cans also, and people are getting to get... Because they can taste New England IPAs or West Coast IPAs or IPAs, hoppy beers as a whole in bottles and cans, and they nowadays they can feel the difference because it's local, it's local product with just 2 or 3 weeks or 1 month old, and they can see the changes in terms of hoppy profile in the beers in cans and in bottles. So I think we are changing the perception around the packaging here in Portugal in the last like 2 years.
So cans, yeah, that they're still going to take over everything.
I hope just for certain kind of beers, because I will not buy a barrel-aged stout in can, like Andre is saying, or a true sour in can. It blows my mind. I can do it. I need a bottle for that kind of beer. I really need a bottle.
Well, if the brewers are saying it, then there's no hope for the rest of us, is there?
Yeah, indeed.
So, guys, so I suppose that brings us around. Where where do you think that the brewing scene is going in each of the countries? Or like, it, you know, brewing scene started, like you said, probably the hoppy West Coast things. It seems to me to be kind of getting more back to kind of traditional and more, maybe more uncontrolled stuff like sours, you know, like spontaneous, like saisons, things like that. Do you think that's the way, and barrel age seems to be the next, a really big thing. Do you think that's the way it's going, or is it splitting into kind of, you know, pastry stouts and barrel age stouts, or where do you think the market is going?
It's probably very different in all the three countries. Well, maybe not very different, but still different, because we are at different stages of development, and we have different, let's say, food and drink cultures, as well as Daniel said, in Portugal, it's a very wine country. But in Lithuania, it's kind of, it's all over the place. Yeah, we had this traditional farmhouse beers, and then we have these modern beers. So what I'd like to see is people going away a little bit from the recent trends of, you know, pastry stouts and I don't know, lactose infused IPAs and things like that, and more towards subtler styles. But we'll see how it goes. Actually, we didn't have that much of this, you know, pastry stout trend in Lithuania, so I cannot complain. I don't want to say it's a bad beer. It's not my favorite, but as I said, I like diversity, so it's great that there are beers like that, you know, over the top beers. But we personally prefer something along more, you know, classic simplicity, complexity, and things like that. So what I can say that sour beers are definitely picking up over the last few years. So I think this trend will continue. More and more people will find sours attracting. On the other hand, I would like to see a little bit more attention to things like to light but subtle but yet complex beers, like, I don't know, English bitters, for example. English bitters are totally unpopular in Lithuania, even though I really love the style. And we had one beer which we just dropped because nobody was buying it. I loved it, but people just were not buying it. So yeah, there's definitely places that this market can go to, and probably will go to eventually. So we will see. Anyway, I expect more subtle complexity to return instead of like over the top beers, and more sours in the future.
Andre, do you think it's the same heading in Sweden, or?
Yeah, I think with hopefully we've come past this extreme style competition, or what do you want to call it. In Sweden, when we started we had around 50 craft breweries in 2012. Now we have around 450.
Wow.
Most of them have been around for a couple of years now, so I guess that also evens out the need for the craft brewery to do that kind of stuff. Maybe they started off doing that and now they're settling with a more genuine profile with what they want to do, like IPAs or if you want to do classic styles, and maybe once in a while do this experimental beers for events and such. But I hope that's the way at least the Swedish market is going. I don't know. I can't come to mind with any other country to compare it with, but I guess Yeah, in the USA, it has been quite the same with a lot of breweries doing a lot of crazy stuff, and now the ones remaining, they're doing what they do best.
And Daniel, that's the same. That's the same. You're going to see. It's a newer market down there in Maine. Do you think you've still got to go through all those phases, or?
I think the market is a monster with its own mind. We have a role in it for sure. The beers we make is the beers that are available in the market. But in last instance, we have a business and we have to do beer that really sells. Because if it doesn't sell, it's just stuck in our cold room, and we can make money. We can only dream with a business that really makes money. To be honest, if I would love that the market will go to through more low ABV beer, more classic beer like Pilsners or Munich Dunkels, lagers, whatever. But to be honest, here in Portugal, I've just born yesterday. I have like 2 years experience, so my words don't give a shit. But I really think here in Portugal, we are truly immersed in the American craft beer cultures. And I think that the products that really sells quickly, fast, and have a really good feedback from the customer are like in-your-face products, like big pastry stouts and smoothie sours with 50% fruit. That kind of stuff is the beers that really sells, like in 2 weeks, 2,000 cans just slipped away. It's the beers that really make an impact here in as a one-off. I don't think if I had a big pastry stout or a ridiculous pastry smoothie sour in my core range and try to sell it over and over again, probably it will not work. I have a smoothie sour and it's a big bestseller in our core range and it works smoothly in Portugal. But yeah, that's my honest opinion about our market. Our market likes like in your face beers and flavors, and yeah, high alcohol beer with in your face flavors. That's my point of view.
Okay.
And I love to drink also that kind of beer. Once, like, sip it, and once in a while, I love to drink that kind of beer, and I understand the market and why people love that kind of beer. But
yeah,
I would, this year, to be honest, in this year, I will make an effort to brew some very well-made low ABV lagers to see what is the reaction of the market, because, yeah, and sour beer is the same. We have, like, Dois Corvos as a big barrel-age program, big for our country barrel-age program. They are brewing truly wonderful Brettanomyces sours, but I don't think it doesn't get the respect they deserve in our market, to be honest. They are really good beers, like high hand, top notch at European level or worldwide level, but people just don't buy them and don't rate it well and don't understand that kind of beers. Probably if they buy one of those beers from the Belgian market, they will blow their head off. But brewed in Portugal, it doesn't have the same shit. I don't understand it, to be honest.
Yeah, the market has to go through all those waves. So, you know, if people are into like big over the top beers, expressive beers, and so it has to go through that stage to actually eventually arrive, you know, that let's say counter trend, weaker or more subtle beers. So yeah, it's definitely a thing here too, because all the over the top beers are still very, very in demand.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting note. I think we probably have to let you go pretty soon, so I won't hold you. But it's an interesting to kind of see where the markets are, because like I said, I just talking to brewers and stuff. It does seem to be heading more towards the more delicate, like you said, maybe lower ABV, more delicate, more subtle beers. And well, actually, we have a comment here from Diaz. I just put up, so he's agreeing with you. Diaz was on, Daniel was on before. He's, yeah, said they want the hype beers. Diaz, he's in Belgium, and he said it's the same thing. It's the hype beers that, and I guess you see that, like, there is that need. Like, do you feel that need to produce a new beer every month or every week that you have to hype out?
I do, to be honest. Yeah, I have the need. In the last year, we had like 3 months or 4 months, I don't remember, without releasing any new over the top stuff. And financially speaking, it was just a disgraceful. So we really need we really have the need to keep launching new beers, over the top beers, or yeah, it's very important for us to get the social medias running, to get the people talking about us, to getting the bars to want it, our beers. So it's really important not to focus only in a core range of 5 beers and to keep always releasing new stuff. Yeah.
Yes, I mean, we've mentioned it, before, like, it's the untapped sort of influence as well, where you have to, people want to just tick off the next beer and the
new beers. Yeah.
Take your beer once.
I was now thinking, here in Portugal, I really felt like 6 or 7 years ago, like maybe 10 probably. Like IPAs was just bitter, like over the top bitterness. And over the time, like with 1 or 2 or 3 weeks, years, people start to emphasize and to appreciate the balance and not the bitter, just balanced. The same with sour beers. In the beginning, here in Portugal, people just wanted like extremely sour, over the top sour beers. And nowadays, they just want a little bit of everything. They just want balance. And I really think with the things I have said before, over time, people now are just amazed with over the top beers, with pastry stouts and heavily fruited kettle sours. But I think over time, we'd want, give them 1 or 2 years and they will just want balance. Balance always win, at least I hope.
Yeah, so it's like a pendulum. It overshoots and then eventually settles. That's the cliche. Listen, guys, I've held you now for way too long. Thanks a million. Is there anything we should have that you wanted to specifically mention or talk about, or anything that I didn't ask or that never came up?
Well, I just wanted to add to this conversation we just had about the customer. I think, you know, in every market, there's probably different proportions of beer drinkers. There are some who are always hunting for new and hyped stuff, but there are always some who, you know, prefer just the good old beer, you know, they enjoy, for example, their favorite, I don't know, IPA or favorite sour or whatever. And those proportions of the market are changing, and they are probably different in every country. So if you are a small brewery, it could well be that, you know, your only customers, like, let's say in Daniel's example, they're probably mostly having those craft beer geeks who are always looking for something explosive. Yeah. But you can also have, you know, a very mixed, I think in our case, we have a very mixed fan base. There are some who are always, you know, the first question they ask is like, do you have something new? And there are those who just say, you know, they pick their favorite brand all the time. You know, there are people who are only buying one beer at our place. For example, Sake, the Spruce Needle beer. And they just love it and they buy it all the time and they don't want anything else. So yeah, we'll see how it develops, but there'll probably always be beer geeks who are looking for something hyper new. It's just that the amount of those people looking for something new and explosive versus something subtle will probably change over time. We'll see how it goes.
Right. Yeah, I think we could. Yeah, I think that's something we can agree on. Guys, is there anything that you wanted to mention there before we go that we didn't touch on, Andre or Daniel?
Just I had a comment about the restaurant bringing craft beers in. It has been quite a change in Sweden, but I think it is because of the amount of craft beer breweries growing that fast. And when they're selling, they can find local restaurants that will sell the local craft beer, which will be very nice for the end customer to be able to drink local beers in certain cities wherever you go all over Sweden. So I guess it depends on how many breweries you have. And of course, if something is local, maybe the local restaurant tend to take it in, and maybe the customers, even though they're local or traveling to that city, they will try the local beers. So in Sweden, that has been there has been a huge difference at restaurants. If you have like a wine list, and maybe you have some local beers from two or three breweries as well, even though it's on tap or can or bottle.
Well, yeah, I mean, that brings up not to drag this out longer, but the whole local side of things. Like, I mean, are people looking for local breweries? I know, I remember, I don't know if you know Killarney, and it's in Kerry in Ireland. It's a huge tourist area. And I was talking to the brewer from there, and he said the reason they got into pubs there, that the local pubs started stocking them, was purely because tourists were coming in and asking, what's the local beer? And if they didn't have a local beer on tap, then they'd go off to the next pub and look for it. So it was tourists were driving that local market. Do you think, I mean, we all know that there's this beer tourism. If you go somewhere, you want to experience the area. How much do you think that is driving kind of the proliferation of breweries versus people who are looking, living in the area, and they want their local brewer?
Beer tourism is definitely a thing, and I think every beer geek, even when not doing like beer tourism, but just visiting another country, you probably each of you would always look for something local to try. Yeah, so there's definitely that trend, and I like it. But I think there's also this part of the market that just wants to have local stuff and support local brands, which I also enjoy. And it probably got stronger during COVID. I think we had many initiatives like support your local brewer around here, so that people would buy local stuff locally, and it's ecologically sound. You know, beer should be produced and consumed locally, where it's freshest and with least transportation costs. So there's definitely both tourism aspect and local aspect in this, and I like the local part of the craft brewing culture, you know, the local community, local ingredients, local distribution. It's a good thing.
Yeah. Okay, Daniel, is there anything there that you wanted to bring up that we didn't mention? And then let you go.
No, just want to thank you guys, to meet you all, Andre and Geddy Minas, and you, Brian, and to be a part of this conversation was truly an honor.
Yeah, okay.
Well, great chat. Thank you. Nice meeting you guys.
Well, hopefully you can get together.
Thank you.
Yeah, hopefully you can get together. I mean, you're all doing pretty interesting stuff, I think I can say. There's some really interesting beers in there. So if anybody gets to Portugal or Sweden or Lithuania, you have to check them out. Hopefully they'll have tap rooms at some in the not too distant future. If not, search out the local bars and stuff and check them out. Definitely all worth having. So guys, I think I'll leave it at that. Thank you a million for taking part. It was, believe it or not, it's nearly an hour and a half. So that's why I need to let you go, because it's been very generous with your time. I'll just play out this video again and say, just say thank you very much to Gediminas, Andre, and Daniel. And hopefully we'll be back again with some more chat at some stage in the not too distant future. Thanks a million.